Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 3, Exposure. So just a couple of quick announcements before we begin. The first one regarding Assignment 1. I just want to let you know that you do not need to do questions number 8 and 9. Those are the last two questions on the problem set style part 2. I will post an updated PDF later tonight or tomorrow. But basically, the reasoning is that I realize that we are not going to be covering that material quite yet. So you'll likely see those questions again on a future problem set, but don't bother doing them. We are not going to grade them if you submit it. You get a free 6 points in that assignment. So hooray. The next is about sections. We finalized the section times. Thank you to all of you that have participated in the poll on the forum. And so now this is the final section schedule that will be valid from here on out, and it is Mondays and Tuesdays, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. in the same room as before, 51 Brattle Street, number 123/5. You can find if you go to the course website, there's a map linked from the course website to the location of 51 Brattle Street if you're not sure. But sections with this schedule begin tomorrow. So tomorrow is Tuesday, we have the first one. Realize that next week is a holiday on Monday, so we will have neither lecture nor section. We'll have another Tuesday section, and then we will resume with these Mondays and Tuesday sections the week after. If you have any questions, do let us know. Okay, so first I figured when we're going to talk about exposure, I think we just need a quick refresher on some pretty relatively basic things regarding light and how we perceive light. So light is literally just some electromagnetic radiation that is emitted by objects or is reflected off of objects, and we can perceive a certain subset of it. So whereas this top bar, that gray bar along the top, represents nearly all of the electromagnetic spectrum, including X-rays, gamma rays, infrared, microwaves, a whole bunch of other stuff, we can only see a small subset of it, this visible spectrum, or all of the colors that we can perceive. Any wavelengths that are shorter or longer than this visible spectrum, we cannot actually see. And there's actually an interesting reason that we can only see this particular part, or at least, there at least seems a strong connection between some fact and the reason that we can see this, and that is that for those of you that are astronomers out there or that are familiar with this physics term called black body radiation, which is basically some energy that is given out by an object. Our sun emits black body radiation, and no, black does not mean that it's emitting this sort of black radiation that we can't see, but it always emits a certain set of radiation that sort of ramps up, and then at a certain frequency it gives off the most radiation, then it sort of goes down in this bell curve sort of fashion. And our sun actually emits the most amount of energy right in the middle of our visible spectrum. Now, whether or not this is a coincidence, you can sort of make that decision for yourself, but it seems like a fairly strong case as to why we can see the visible spectrum as it is today is because of the sun's emitting of radiation in certain frequencies. So going back to light itself, there are a couple of basic properties of light. It's sort of funky in that it acts both as a wave, like a wave on the ocean or a wave when you're messing with a slinky, but it also acts like a particle. So there's a little photon that travels along this electromagnetic wave, and both of these properties give light some very, very unique features. One thing is that it has this frequency. So like waves can be faster or slower, much the same way light can. And this is that frequency that I'm talking about. Higher frequency is along the left side, and a lower frequency is along the right. And another way you can think of it is a wavelength. So if we have light that's much like a wave, it goes sinusoidally like this. The wavelength is basically the distance between any two similar points. And so as this elongates, the frequency goes down. But don't worry too much about this. Just take this for what it is. Just accept this as true for now. But the other really neat thing about it is that it also acts as a particle. So there are along this this electromagnetic radiation a photon, and the number of photons that exist determine the brightness. So whereas the wavelength here determines the color, or in other words, another term for this wavelength could be the energy of that, this particle, this photon, the quantity of these photons actually give you light, or the perception of light. So as light increases, or as photons increases, our perception of brightness also increases. So if we double the number of photons, we're essentially doubling the intensity of the light. Now our eyes play some trick on us, and just because we have a doubling of photons doesn't necessarily mean that we perceive it as being twice as bright. But this is going to be very, very important to us. You must remember that the number of photons, we can literally double or halve the number of photons to double or halve the brightness. And this is going to be very important to us when we're talking about exposure for digital photography. So going back to this wave, there's another interesting property of this wave. So light doesn't just travel sort of up and down. It can also travel sideways in a particular motion or at some sort of oblique angle. So right now I've driven this wave going up and down on the blackboard, but imagine it coming out and in on a different plane. And this is called polarization of light. So if for any of you that have polarized sunglasses, for example, or a polarizing filter, what this does is it blocks out certain polarization of this wave. So for example, maybe this wave that's drawn in this direction will be allowed through this filter, and a wave that's coming out and into the blackboard is not allowed through. So in this way, we are able to further change our perception of light using this sort of polarization technique. And don't worry, we will go the classic E7 trademark phrase here. We will go over all of this later on when we talk about polarizing filters. So next, before we dive into cameras, I figure we should just do a pretty quick thing about the eye. You'll notice that there are some similarities between the eye and a camera. So just a really basic and quick and dirty anatomy lesson, which you won't really have to know for a grade, but it's certainly interesting to know, is that we have the iris here, the lens which focuses the light, the macula that you can see at the back is where the light tends to fall when it is focused on the lens. And this macula actually contains something called a fovea. And the fovea actually contains the most number of cells in the back of your eye, or cone cells, that are responsible for viewing detail. So it's only a very, very small fraction of the back of the eye that can actually perceive great detail or can perceive great amounts of color. And so we are constantly looking around in order to focus what we want to look at into the center of that macula or into this fovea in order to view what we want to see in great detail. That doesn't mean, of course, that there are no photocells elsewhere. We do have a variety of cells surrounding the macula throughout the eye that provide us different levels of visual acuity, and we'll talk more about that in just 1 second. So you'll notice that there is actually an optic nerve. Let's see. So if this is the macula, if you can see with my mouse, right next to it we have the optic nerve, and there's actually a lack of photocells that you have here. And for those of you that are familiar with the blind spot in your eye, this is actually where that blind spot exists. Because the nerve comes in, there are no photoreceptors there, so your brain actually sort of maps what it thinks should be the image over that space. You actually have no photocells. You cannot actually see when you're looking at something through the blind spot. And there's some really neat tests online where you can try to find your blind spot, and it usually consists of something like a white page or a white image, and there's two dots, and you're supposed to look at one dot at a certain distance from your monitor, and the other dot will disappear. And when that happens, you know that you have found the location of your optic nerve, because your brain is filling in that spot with the background color or white, so it looks like it has disappeared. Let's take another look at this. So we can see here that now we have a different view of the eye, and you can see a little bit better the fovea that's near the bottom. You can see that we have the lens up near the top, the iris, the cornea, and much like a camera lens, our iris can actually close or open, just like many of you are familiar with, in order to let in more or less light. And this is actually very, very important and a very good analogy to the aperture in a camera, which we will discuss a little bit later. So like I said, don't worry too much about the anatomy. We will. This is really just more for your information and certainly interesting. I was a bio major many years ago, so I find this stuff really fascinating. So anyway, we have different types of photocells in the eye. We have rods and cones, and hopefully this sounds familiar to most of you, but each photocell is responsible for different sorts of visual acuity. So the cones are largely responsible for giving us detail and color, and the rods are much more important for giving us low light vision and some motion in our periphery. When I'm talking about the fovea actually has a huge concentration of cones. It has very, very few rods in the fovea, and that is to give you the most amount of detail in the center of your eye as possible. As you get farther and farther away from the fovea, you get fewer cones, and you get a higher distribution of rods. So what is the difference between rods and cones? Well, like I said before, rods give you night vision, whereas cones are more used for day vision. Rods are much more sensitive to light than cones are, so that when it's bright, for example, when you're outside on a sunny day, your rods will be essentially disabled or turned off, and your cones will be primarily turned on, and that's how you can see during the day. However, at night, when you walk into a dark room, and after your eyes adjust, the rods are now much more responsible for your vision. And certainly right now, I'm sure all of you can still perceive color, so your cones are not actually turned off right now, or disabled, so to speak. But if you go into a very, very dark room, so if you go into a cave, for example, and there's very, very little light, you can the primary cells responsible for your vision will be the rods, because your cones just cannot give you as much detail at night. And in fact, there are some sources online that say that, well, many people do say that the rods can actually perceive one photon per cell, which is actually very, very impressive. It's very, very high sensitivity to light, whereas cones are many thousands or many hundreds of times less sensitive to light. Okay, so I sort of blew right through the second one. So because rods are night vision, are used for night vision, and the cones are for day vision, the rods, therefore, are more sensitive to light, and the cones are less sensitive. Like I mentioned before, rods are not found in the fovea, the primary center of your vision, which you generally use to focus and look at detail. And what's interesting is that as you move away, like I said, from the fovea into the surrounding area of the eye, you get 22 times as many rods, or maybe 20 times as many rods, than cones in the retina. So for those of you that are interested in astrophotography, whenever you're looking for something that's very, very dark, so maybe you're looking for a specific set of star clusters in the sky, or even when you're just trying to walk around at night, don't look with the center of your eye. Don't look at the center of your vision. And you may have heard this used before, and this is the reason why. You have many more rods surrounding the fovea, so out of the periphery of your vision, and you'll be able to see objects that are much darker much more easily by not looking at them directly. So just look at something and then look a little bit away from it, and you will suddenly, if you're paying attention to that, to just that area in your vision, you will be able to notice perhaps contrast, or you'll be able to even see an object where you couldn't before when you were actually looking at it.
That's why when you look at something and close your eyes, you can kind of see it's kind of like brighter maybe than I could. So you might, if I look at this screen here and close my eyes, you also see like a square.
Oh, so that's a different effect. So when you're looking at a bright object, and then like you close your eyes and you can see the inverse of that, that's because so as your cells get used to brightness or to the amount of intensity of light, they actually try to compensate by sending a negative signal, so the reverse signal. So if you're looking at something that's very, very red, so I only have this fuchsia here, for example, and if you look at something that's very, very red and then close your eyes, you actually see the inverse of that color. And the reason is that your eyes are trying to compensate the other way so that it doesn't overcome that signal. It's It's all very interesting, but that's a separate thing. Yes.
So is it either all rods or all cones, or do you have a mixture?
No. There's definitely a mixture. There's not all rods and all cones. In the fovea, you do have many, many more cones, but you may have a dispersal of rods. And as you move away from the fovea, you get fewer cones and more rods. So it's just sort of this gradient, so to speak. However, everybody is different, actually, and we all have different distributions of rods and cones as you move away from the fovea. So it really varies by the person, but it's not sort of black and white, so to speak. Okay, so the rods, because they are much more sensitive to light, or not because of, but in addition to being much more sensitive to light, they can only really be stimulated by, well, one color, so to speak. So when you're looking at objects with your rods, you won't necessarily be able to determine color. This is why when it's very dark at night, you can't see color as well, because your cones are disabled, so to speak, like I mentioned before, and you're using your rods, which can really only tell you the brightness, sort of a grayscale version of what you are looking at. The cones, however, will give you color. Okay, so because of the way rods work, a whole bunch of rods are usually clustered into one in order to amplify a signal. You usually use rods to detect motion. So this is another reason why rods are helpful in the periphery. We can notice motion very, very well in the periphery of your vision because of the high frequency of rods outside of the fovea. Whereas cones are used, they're a bit slower, so to speak. Well, they don't detect motion as well, but they can detect detail very, very well. So we can imagine that a variety of things happens when we lose either the rods or the cones. So what happens, for example, if we lose rods, if we are born without them, or something happens to our rods?
No night vision.
That's right, no night vision. So we lose the ability to see at night. And cones, well, cones is a bit trickier because you lose the loss of detail in the center of your vision. You lose the ability to see color. You lose a whole bunch of things. Okay, so talking about color a little bit, we can see that there's various wavelengths or frequencies of light that impact different types of cells. So when I broke it down into rods and cones, that's a bit of an oversimplification. We actually have one type of rod that's used in the eye and three different types of cones at least. And each type of cone is affected by different frequencies of light. And so you can see that they're labeled S, M, and L. For short wavelengths, medium wavelengths, and long wavelengths. Or if we go back here, we can see that the short wavelengths at 400 nanometers is a blue or a violet, medium is more yellow or orange, and the longer ones are red. So that is what each of these types of cones, oh boy, that's what each of these types of cones will actually give to you. So the brain then, much in the same way that a computer screen mixes different varieties of colors in order to show you one color, or what we perceive as one color, the same thing happens in our eye. A certain color will affect certain number of cones, and our brains will mix that information together to tell us what color we are actually looking at. So you can imagine that if we are seeing something that's really only stimulating the long cones, for example, then we will be looking at something that's red. But if we're looking at a combination of medium and long, then we will see perhaps yellow. A mix between green and red. And something that's very interesting is that the vast majority of cones in our eyes are the M and L types. We actually cannot see, or we cannot perceive blue wavelengths as strongly. And this actually gives us some interesting results when we talk about histograms in a later lecture. It actually impacts how we view something to be bright. So something that may be emitting a lot of blue color, for example, won't look as bright to us subjectively as something that is red or green. Okay, so I've been glossing over, or I haven't even mentioned, this fourth graph that's here, this rod, the R for rod, the dashed line that exists there. You'll notice that it also is impacted by a certain frequency of light, and it sort of drops off as you get to about 600 nanometers. In fact, your rods cannot actually perceive light, or not impacted by light at all, by any light that's greater than 640 nanometers, red light. So let's say you are in a very, very dark room and you need to illuminate something. The best light to use would be red light, as red as you can possibly get, because it will not impact your rods, it will not cause them to shut down, and you will turn on these L-type cones, and so that you can see this object that's in front of you in detail, but without destroying your night vision. For just about all of us, it takes about 30 minutes to fully accustom ourselves to truly dark, truly night vision, and you won't destroy all of that work that you've done by using a longer wavelength, by using a red light. And there's actually anecdotally, if you've ever been in different types of cars, you'll notice that many cars have different color of dashboards, and there's green ones and white ones, and sometimes orange and red ones, and usually the ones then that we can infer from this, the ones that are better for your night vision would then be the longer wavelengths ones. So maybe not orange, that might be a little bit too far to the left, encroaching into our rods, but certainly red would be great so that we could maintain our night vision. However, you can make an argument that we'd have headlights on anyway and we don't have night vision, but the point remains. Okay, so just a couple of other interesting facts. The M and L type cones are dictated by the X chromosome. And so for a lot of males that have color blindness, and the reason that males are impacted more frequently than females for color blindness is because of this fact. If there is some defect in that gene, or for whatever reason that gene is not expressed, and one of these cones is not put into the eye, during development, then you will actually lose the ability to see some subset of colors. And so the primary type of color blindness then would be either losing the deletion of one of these M or L type cones from the retina, so that you would therefore lose the associated types of colors when looking at it. There are actually, so just another aside, there are actually people that have a fourth type of cone, and they can see even more sets of colors, as people would argue, but we won't really get into that. Okay, so let's take a look at this in a more general way. If we look at the eye in comparison to a camera, we can see that there's actually quite a bit of similarity between the two. We have light that enters through the front. It's focused by the lens, and we do have a lens in our eye. It's also impacted by the iris, which will open or close depending on how much light should be entered into your eyes. And much the same way in our camera, light comes in, is focused by the lens, and falls into the rear, the sensor, where the light is picked up and converted into signals that we can actually use. It's an interesting similarity, and certainly when cameras were invented many years ago, I question whether or not they actually were aware of the number of similarities that existed, but that's neither here nor there. Okay, so exposure. Notice that I mentioned before that when there is a doubling or halving in the number of photons, we are doubling or halving the intensity or the brightness of a particular object or source light, some object that is emitting light or reflecting light. And we actually call this doubling or halving of light in photographic terms a stop. So when we are increasing the light by one stop, that means we are doubling the number of photons in the scene. When we are halving it, we are subtracting a stop. So there's a variety of names for stops. You'll sometimes hear it called exposure values as well, but really don't get confused. It's all the same thing. So you'll notice that this is a crop of the pinhole photo that we took in the first lecture. And I've increased the exposure by one stop and then two stops to show you what the difference looks like. And I bet for the majority of you, one plus one EV doesn't actually look twice as bright as plus zero. And again, this is the way that our eyes perceive it. However, when we are actually talking about the real photons that are coming into the camera, this is what the camera perceives as the difference. I actually did this using software. I obviously didn't take this photo three different times. And we certainly, this implies that there is a way after you take a photo to be able to change the stops of a photo. And we will get into that, of course, at a later time. Notice that as we start to overexpose, and overexposure is an increase in stops, we start to lose detail from not only the subjects, but also the background. So in the plus zero EV photo, you can notice the detail from the window behind this projector stand or podium. And then in this plus two EV, you actually lose the ability to see that detail. This is a limitation of cameras, not necessarily of our eyes. And we'll get into all of this, why this happens later. Okay. So I just wanted to show off the pinhole photo again. If you haven't seen it, it is also up in the forum. So when we are talking about exposure, we are talking about changing the exposure value, or we're talking about changing the number of stops on a camera to match whatever light is coming into it. So when there is a lot of light coming in, so for example, maybe you're outside, in order to keep your camera from looking overexposed like this, you must dial down the number of stops so that you can get a properly exposed photo. Now, there's a variety of ways to do this. The first one is shutter speed. So remember that in a camera, there is a shutter that opens to let light hit the sensor, and then it closes so that light no longer hits the sensor. Now, if you adjust the time that this shutter is open, you're also changing the amount of time that photons can hit the sensor. So if we have, for a given amount of light, if we double the amount of time that this shutter is open, what are we doing effectively in terms of photons? That's right, we have twice as many photons, so now the picture will appear to be twice as bright. So we have increased the stop by one, so to speak, and we are actually allowing one stop additional light to enter into the camera. So if you have a photo that's way too dark, this is one of the things that you can do to try to get more light into it. You can increase, or you can decrease rather, the shutter speed, or you can increase the amount of time that the shutter is open. However, there is a downside to this. If you have the shutter open for a lot longer, all of that light is coming in, and this would be fine for very, very fast shutter speeds, so maybe 1/8,000th of a second, 1/4,000th of a second. You're probably not going to really be able to tell the difference. But when we get closer to the second range, a half second versus 1 second makes all the difference in the world in terms of the light that is coming in and how sharp something will look. So this pinhole photo, for example, was taken with a shutter speed of 309 seconds. So for just over 5 minutes, 5 minutes and 9 seconds, the shutter was open, collecting light from the pinhole. And you'll notice that there's a lot of blurriness and movement that you can capture as a result. So for example, this person's head back here, you can see that he moved or she moved back and forth a couple of times. And the reason that all of that is captured is that all of this light that's coming in is added together to produce this final image. And to give an example of this, there's a programming language called processing, and what it allows you to do is actually create some visual programs with it very, very easily. And something that I created that's pretty stupid in terms of its intelligence, but also I think demonstrates this very nicely, is this program that will basically take a photo with the webcam that's embedded into the top of my computer. So if I click start here, I'll try to smile. Let's see. It shows on this. So let me change one thing. Okay, so now I'm going to show you. All right, that's a terrible photo. All right, so now watch the screen. Don't watch me, but watch the screen. What it's going to do is that every time it collects some photons and adds them together, it makes the image a little bit brighter so that you can see movement in it, for example. So if I just stand perfectly still, eventually it gets bright enough, and then it determines, okay, that's properly exposed, and then it will show you the end photo. But if I'm moving while this is happening and realize that it took some amount of time for it to collect enough photons, so if I'm moving, I'll pretend like I'm running. Oh, no. Okay, you can see that we get this blurriness that results because while this shutter was open, so to speak, it was taking in all of the light, and I was moving in that time period that this had happened. So now I look like a blurry mess and arguably much better than I did just a few minutes ago. Okay, so back to this. So there are for many cameras, you have a hard limit in terms of how long you can keep the shutter open. Most cameras, this is about 30 seconds, some it's 15, some it's 10 seconds. You can manually set how long the shutter can be open, but only up until that time. And that's where this separate mode comes in. It's called a bulb mode. And this bulb mode, which I used to take this pinhole photo, as long as you're holding down the shutter button on the front of the camera, it will keep the shutter open. And so you may realize, well, you may remember that that I didn't really hold the camera for 5 minutes, and that's because I was using a remote, and the remote has a shutter lock mechanism, so it was able to remain open. I was able to lock it and time how long I needed the shutter to be open. So, but if you have this bulb mode, you can take much, much longer photographs, and this is great for night shots. If you are using a pinhole, for example, where you are not collecting a lot of light because of the very small aperture, and for any variety of reasons that you would want the shutter to be open for minutes at a time. Yes?
Is in bulb mode, aren't you going to eventually run against buffer limitations? Because isn't the sensor capturing the data all the time?
Good question. So in bulb mode, aren't we going to run into buffer limitations? So the way that... So it works on a much lower level than that in order to collect these photons. It's a feature of the sensor itself. So as the light comes in, every pixel is summing up the data on its own rather than every millisecond or nanosecond taking essentially the photons that it's detected and dumping it into memory and then adding it up in memory, if that makes sense. So this is occurring more on the sensor level rather than in the memory, in the computer level for a camera. So no, you will not run into buffer limitations when using bulb mode. The only limitation that you'll have, frankly, is heat, because your camera sensor is, it's like a little computer chip, it's a little processor. It will actually generate a bit of heat, especially as you keep it open. You'll get some weird heat spots, usually along the edges of your frame. And the other issue is obviously battery life. You can't have it open maybe for an hour without your battery starting to become significantly degraded. Okay, so I just want to switch back to this other method. Oh, puts it all the way over there. All right. So there's a variety of really interesting, really neat effects that you can do by altering the shutter speed. So not only can you alter the shutter speed to get more or less light in, but you get interesting effects with it as well. So, for example, in that pinhole photo, even though it wasn't necessarily wanted, we were able to blur everybody out just by summing all of that light that was coming in. You can also use it much more specifically. So, in this case, this is a photo of some fireworks where usually as the fireworks explode and start to hit the ground, they don't make long streaks, but if you increase the shutter speed, that light is constantly entering the camera as it falls, and you get this sort of laser ray of doom that comes from the sky and enters into the river. So this is certainly one way that you can get some neat effects. And for those of you that have ever seen photos of like cars on a freeway, for example, and you usually see really long streaks of white and red cars, this effect was done in a similar way. The shutter speed was held open for a really long amount of time in order to get those streaks to become very much softer. The problem with using very long shutter speeds like this is that you can't hold the camera for yourself, because I guarantee that no matter how stable or sturdy of a person you are, you won't be able to keep the camera held still enough to keep the photo remaining sharp. So here, for example, even though the photo was taken over a 10-second time period, the boats, for example, are still sharp because I wasn't holding it. It was put on a tripod. And so if you remember from a few lectures ago when I recommended very much that one of the first things you get for yourself as a photographer is a tripod, this is the reason why. You then can really increase the number of photos that you can take by having a sturdy tripod that you can put your camera on and be sure that it's not going to move anywhere as you keep the shutter open. Generally, there is a sort of general rule of thumb, and that is that if you have a focal length, so in this case, this is a 50 millimeter lens, this really only works for SLRs, but you can do some conversions with smaller cameras as well and get a similar get a similar number. But this is a 50 millimeter lens. Generally, I wouldn't want to hold the camera for any amount of time that's less than, or that's greater than 1/50th of a second. So if you take the focal length, do 1 divided by that, you can then determine the fastest amount of time, or the slowest amount of time, rather, that you can comfortably hold the camera and be able to get a sharp shot. So if it was 1/25th of a second, for example, which realizes now is twice as slow, so to speak, as the 1/50th, then I really should use a tripod. However, there are some tricks you can use. Some really popular ones that people like to do is just to use whatever's available that's sturdy. So if you have a flat surface, that works equally well. Usually what you find out in public, like when these photos were taken, is you might have a railing, for example. And when those railings are curved, it makes it very, very difficult to put a camera on there. But if you put your camera on a railing and just push it down, just hold it down as hard as you can, usually you will decrease the amount of vibrations and really help get a sharper shot when you're taking a photograph. Okay, so realize that we're talking about millions of pixels in one of these sensors. And if you remember from a few lectures ago when I actually showed the size of the sensor, it was relatively large. But still, when we're talking about thousands of pixels being in this sensor, we're talking about millimeters or micrometers worth of space that can be used if you shift the camera that much, just a micrometer. The light that should have been falling on some pixel will now fall on the adjacent pixel, and that will be slightly blurry. So that's certainly important to get a tripod, because I don't think any of us can hold a camera still in a frame of micrometers or millimeters in order to do that. Okay, so there's some other effects that people really like, and that is with water. Usually to get this soft water that looks sort of milky white, you use a very long shutter speed to really soften it and smoothen it out. Whereas if you remember, we had the slide of the rafting trip where there was water that was splashing and you could see each individual little droplet. That was using very, very fast shutter speed in order to do that. This is using very, very slow shutter speed. This was open for 2 seconds. I print all of the data on the lower left-hand side of the photo so that you can take a look at it. This was open for 2 seconds in order to get the water enough time to smoothen out. I really would have preferred a longer time, but I didn't have all of the equipment with me at the time, and I was sort of limited by a variety of things. I really must say that when you're taking a photo like this, be really careful. For this photo in particular, I had my tripod in the water. I was downhill, and I had it in the water. And I was using, with long shutter speeds, I like to use the remote shutter button, because when you touch the camera, even when it's on a tripod, when you touch it to take a photo, even if you're really, really careful, you generally are going to move the camera just ever so slightly enough where you would be able to perceive a slight bit of blurriness in your end photo. If you use a camera remote such as this, you can connect it to the camera and perhaps stabilize it. So what I'd like to do is plug it in and then wrap it around this little doohickey that's back here. And now I can move this around, and it doesn't actually... Okay, let's try this again. All right, so now I can move this around, and it doesn't actually move the cable here. It doesn't actually move the camera around. You can get a much sharper image. Okay, so anyway, I was doing that, and then I was packing up because I was very happy with the results of some of these photos, and I dropped this remote into the water. And it didn't work for a long time after that, but I then opened it up, and I must say, these remotes are really expensive for no good reason, because when you open it up, it's literally like a button, and there's a little tiny spring in there and like two pieces of metal, and that's it. And there's really nothing to it. So I took it all apart and let it dry out, and then it seemed to work fine after that. But do be careful with all of your equipment, because you can really lose some very, very easily. Okay, so I was talking about this very generally, all of this blur that can happen when something is moving. We generally refer to this as motion blur. So you'll get motion blur when something is moving and the shutter speed is long enough that you actually get this blur as a result of it. However, you can also do the opposite. You can freeze action by using a very fast shutter speed. So whereas the previous one had a shutter speed of 2 seconds, this one uses 1/1250th of a second. So this is very, very fast, and it was able to capture, to freeze the motion of not only the soccer players, but also the soccer ball that they were kicking as well. So it really depends on what you want to do. Do you want to capture motion blur, or do you want to capture, to freeze the action, so to speak? And even here, I think it's really important to be able to, or to use a tripod, because it is possible for you to move the camera enough that you can get some slight motion blur. And it's much easier when you have the camera on some sturdy surface that you can move around to be able to capture this motion, even this motion, very still without having to worry about getting any sort of blur in it. So it is possible to actually combine these two techniques to use a long shutter speed and get motion blur, but also try to make something sharp. And that was given an example just a little while ago, but this is a different example where, yes, this is self-portrait, and yes, I'm embarrassed by this photo, but you can, I placed my tripod on the seat next to me and drove around for a bit using the remote shutter in order to take a photo. And I tried to remain as still as possible, which made for some close calls on corners, but you're able to capture using even just 2.5 seconds of time if so long as the camera is still relative to the rest of the car, you can capture the interior of the car quite sharply. So you can notice that the dials and controls on the far right are relatively sharp, while the buildings behind the window are not. They have motion blur. Yeah, the steering wheel is in between. You actually can't see my left arm, but it was moving up to turn left. And it actually looks like the steering wheel rim is just floating there because you can't see the spokes that hold the steering wheel rim to the base of the steering wheel. So it's pretty neat. And I think if you zoom in really far, you can see how fast I was going. It wasn't too fast in this one, luckily, so no problems there. Oh, and this was a little one of those sandals air fresheners that was swinging back and forth, which I miss those. I haven't used that in a while. Okay, but anyway, you can actually combine both a sharp photo and motion blur, so long as whatever you want to be sharp doesn't move. So to go back to this rafting idea, you can really stop motion very, very well, even for something that appears to us to be moving very quickly. So whereas we may not be able to notice all the fine detail in this water falling off of the raft by stopping the motion with a fast shutter speed, in this case, 1/1000th of a second, we can really get some additional detail. Okay, so let's say that we take a photo at 1/60th of a second. Let's say we want to make it one stop brighter. How do we do that? From 1/60th of a second, what is one stop brighter? 100. Yep, 1/30th. Because we need it to be open twice as long, and remember that fractions are sort of, it makes it sort of backwards for us. So 1/30th means that the shutter is open for longer, for twice as long as 1/60th. So how about the other way, when we want to make it one stop lower, or one stop darker? From 1/60th.
120.
Yep, 1/120th. That's right. So, now you can go from 1 second. You can now figure out the entire range of shutter speeds that are available to you. And most of your cameras will help you out in this regard. But you can go from 1 second to half a second to a quarter of a second to 1/8, so on and so forth. And you'll notice as you scroll through that a lot of these should make sense. One additional thing is that cameras don't always give you all of the data in pure stop format. Usually they do it in half or third of a stop. So whereas you might have something from 1/60th, where 1/60th of a second is one stop away from 1/30th of a second, usually your camera will give you these intermediary options, so 1/40th and 1/50th of a second. But realize that those themselves are not one stop away. That's just 2/3 of a stop or 1/3 of a stop. And because one stop is relatively crude in terms of you're doubling or halving the number of light, you usually want some finer control. And that's what that option is there for, so that you can, by looking at a photograph, you can determine, well, it doesn't really quite look a whole stop brighter. Maybe I just need a half a stop or a third of a stop darker than this. So to go back to this rafting trip, and again, to mention protecting your equipment when you are out in these sort of dangerous situations. You may have noticed my bomb holding box here. I've gotten so much crap from airport security for this thing. I can't even tell you. But I really love this case. If you find yourself wanting to do photos in situations where there's going to be a lot of water or just a lot of dropping or what have you. I find that these pelican cases are really, really excellent. They're watertight, they float, all sorts of things, but I think I read the warranty card, and I think that they say that they warranty the box against everything except, and let's see, it was shark bite, bear attack, and children under 3, I think. So all of those things will not, your camera will not be protected from all of those things, but just about everything else. And in fact, I have actually dropped this case into rivers before, and it just floats, and it's wonderful. So if you need to protect your stuff, these are great little cases. Okay, so you may realize that, well, when we are working with a given scene, we only have so much light that's available to us for us to work with. It may not be practical to work within the camera's limits and be able to increase or decrease the shutter speed as we want. So we do actually have a couple of other options available to us. The first one is ISO. The ISO is essentially the sensitivity of the sensor to light. Excuse me. So as you increase the ISO, you are increasing the sensitivity. And ISO is very, very easy to calculate. Usually it starts at ISO 100 or 50. And as you double or halve the ISO, you are doubling or halving, respectively, the sensitivity of the camera. So going from ISO 100 to 200 means that your camera is now twice as sensitive to light. So now in this same situation back here, where I took this photo at 1/1000th of a second in ISO 400, you can actually now change the ISO to be able to change your shutter speed. So you can do this sort of give and take, this compromise, so to speak, between the two. So there is actually a downside to increasing the ISO, and that, as you can see, is the increased noise that you get, particularly in compact cameras. And it's not perhaps as visible here on the screen as I would like it to be, but hopefully it is a bit more on the slides that were handed out. And certainly, if you download the slides from the website, you can really see the difference between ISO 100, which looks relatively clean, and ISO 1600, which has a lot of noise, not only in the gray box, but the black box, and also visible noise in this cyan photo of the, I believe that's the queen's head on a penny or a bill or something like that. I'm sorry?
It's from a postage stamp.
A postage stamp, yes. So it must be, I think it's England, because I got these photos from DP Review, digitalphotographyreview.com, and I think they're based in London, I believe. So anyway, as you increase the ISO, you're going to get additional noise. So it's great that you might imagine, oh, I can now increase the sensitivity for free, so to speak, where you don't really have to alter the appearance of the photo, but that's really not true, especially in compact cameras. You get this, as you increase the ISO in compact cameras, you get a very drastic increase in noise, and it can really destroy the look of a photo, in my opinion. Let's see, so this was taken from a Canon PowerShot SX100IS, which is probably now a couple of years old. But realize that the size of the camera, the size of the sensor, literally determines how noisy, it's one of the factors that determines how noisy it is going to be. And this is another reason why I so disagree with vendors and marketers that really push megapixels out to people buying cameras, is because as you increase the megapixels, you are generally going to make it more difficult for them to increase the ISO without giving you a lot of extra noise as well. And what do we usually say? We will talk about that later. So now we have so we have here two photos, one from ISO 100 and one from ISO 1600, and we can tell that this is a number of stops away. So we go to ISO 200, 400, 800, 1600. This is four stops of leeway, so to speak, that we have to work with in this camera. So really the range, when you're using these simple modes like this automatic modes in a camera, usually they will automatically try to determine which ISO to use given the situation, depending on whether it's low light or what have you. But usually the camera will only pick a subset of available ISO. So I think from this camera specifically, although it has the capability of doing ISO 1600, when you're in the simpler modes, it will only go up to ISO 800 if it needs to. And so this further tells you the power of being able to set these features by yourself, because then you can really override what the camera thinks should be done. Okay, so now let's compare it to a digital SLR. So this is the compact camera, and now we have a digital SLR. And so you'll notice that it's the same number of stops difference. It's four stops difference from ISO 100 to 1600. And one of the things that really jumps out is how much better the noise is at ISO 1600. So I'm not sure if you can really tell the difference between ISO 100 and 1600, but there is visible noise between the two. So digital SLRs are not infallible in terms of this, but it's much better than these compact cameras. So digital SLRs can really be used for low light situations much better than compact cameras for this reason, if for nothing else. And even the ISO 100, so realize that the amount of noise among cameras is different at every ISO range. And so even ISO 100, which is the lowest possible amount of noise that you'll get, will vary. And you can usually tell, and you can in this case as well, that ISO 100 in the digital SLR's case is cleaner than the ISO 100 in the compact camera's case. And in many digital SLRs, you can actually go several stops up, so maybe ISO 400, before you start to notice the amount of graininess, so to speak, or the amount of noise that exists in an image that rivals an ISO 100 in a compact camera. So notice that, so this camera in particular, which is a Canon 40D, so it's now not the freshest camera on the block, and you can imagine that newer ones do actually improve their noise characteristics. But this one even goes up to an additional step, ISO 3200. So you get an additional stop of detail, or an additional stop of ISO, of sensitivity, for you to work with in this case. There are some really impressive cameras that have come out lately that now cost insane amounts of money. The Nikon D3 and the Canon 5D Mark II, they now allow you to go up to ISO not only 3200, not only 6400, not only 12,800, but 25,600, which is absolutely insane. It is absolutely ridiculous. That's four stops above ISO 1600. And so although you may get quite a bit of noise at that higher 25,600 range, you just have much more leeway when talking about this. And really, it can literally make the difference between getting a shot in low light or not getting it. So just to give you an idea, this is a photo. So it's not the same photo, but I tried to find two similar photos to compare what graininess looks like in terms of film and compare it to the maximum ISO of this Nikon D3. And so you can see that that film really these days just cannot touch the noise characteristics or how smooth a photo is coming out of a digital camera. So on the left, we have a film photo that's taken with ISO 1600, and you can really see the grain and the noise that is accompanied with it. And on the right, you can see the four stops higher ISO 25600 from the Nikon D3, where it looks equally noisy perhaps, but that is four stops additional sensitivity that you just cannot take in film. And so, I mean, this may sound like I'm really harshing on film, but I must say that I much prefer the noise that exists in film to that over digital, because usually digital noise is somewhat patternized, and it may look kind of chaotic and random, but if you take a step back and look at the picture as a whole, you can really start to notice some patterns in it. Sometimes you'll see like lines of noise, other times you'll see like squares of noise, and it just looks very, very distracting in some cases, whereas film is much more pleasing because it's very, very random. It's much more natural, much more organic of a noise. So given the two, I would take film, but really can't compete with the additional sensitivity of digital these days. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break for now, and when we come back, we will continue talking about exposure. Okay, welcome back, everybody. So I just wanted to go over some things really quickly. We had a couple of good questions during the break. So this dotted line that was shown on this graph, that's the response curve to the rod cells, not to any of the cones. So you see how it drops off very close to the 600 nanometers. That mirrors what I was saying before, how essentially your rods are not affected by light that is over 600 nanometers in wavelength. So I was also talking about polarized light and the sort of polarization technique that can happen. And this is going to be a very poor demonstration because I don't have any better technology or a slinky available. Does anybody have a slinky, by the way? Okay, I guess not. So I just want to show you. So imagine that along this cord, I'm going to initiate a wave. So it goes up and down, for example. If I am polarizing this wave, then imagine that I have two wooden blocks that along that direction of the wave. And if the wooden blocks are vertical, I can then make this wave go up and down with no problem. The wooden blocks allow that wave to pass through. However, if I then make this wave go back and forth towards me and towards you, those wooden blocks would then stop that wave from propagating through. And that's the same sort of technique that I was talking about before with polarized light. If you have polarized sunglasses, it doesn't allow certain polarized light through. And it's that same sort of analogy that you can envision. So all very good questions. Thank you. Okay, so back to ISO. We were talking earlier about independently shutter speed, how you can double or halve the shutter speed in order to, well, so let me say this differently. You can double the amount of time that the shutter is open or have it to double or have the brightness or the stops, not the stops, but the brightness or the photons that are coming into the camera respectively. And likewise with ISO, you can double the ISO to increase the sensitivity. You can have it to decrease. So we can actually combine the two in order to get some very, very useful things. So for example, this photograph is a long exposure photograph. It was taken at 846 seconds long at an ISO of 400. And the reason that it was taken with such a high ISO is that by increasing the ISO, it now becomes more sensitive to light. So that means that I can use a shorter amount of time that the shutter needs to be open in order to properly expose the photograph. So realize that there's a very limited span of allowed light intensity into your camera that your camera will actually register. This is called dynamic range. And if you can have a very, very wide dynamic range and be allowed a lot of light, a lot of different intensities of light to be picked up by the camera, but still, all cameras are physically limited in terms of dynamic range, so that we can only have certain amounts of light that come in to the camera for us to be able to detect it. So this means that we must adjust all of these features, the ISO, the F number that we'll get to in a minute, and the shutter speed in order to make sure that the light that's coming in will properly expose a photograph. So with that in mind, this target exposure, so to speak, I was able to find whatever exposure was required in order to take this photograph. Then I realized that I really wanted the stars to be longer, to have a longer star trail. So what would I do in that case in order to have a longer star trail? This is motion blur, so what would I do? That's right, have a longer amount of time that the shutter is open, or in other words, decrease the shutter speed. And I say decrease because speed is, you know, how fast it is. So I'm sure we can get into a big argument about what is up and down and left and right, but for now, I'll just use that terminology. So you'll notice that on the left, I have a star trail that's, you know, so many, that has a certain length, and then on the right, I have a second photo that is just approximately as well as exposed and has approximately double the star length. And so if you actually look at the details, you can tell that the shutter speed was approximately twice as long. So here on the left, I have 336 seconds, just under 6 minutes. And on the right, it's 846 seconds, which is considerably longer. So that's about 14 minutes. So it's just about twice as long. But in order to do this, I had to modify something else in the camera so that I didn't make sure that not too much light entered the camera and I got overexposure. So on the right, then, not only did I increase or did I decrease the shutter speed, but I also decreased the sensitivity of the sensor. So I went from an ISO 800, which was more sensitive, which allowed me to have a faster shutter speed, to ISO 400, which allowed me to have a longer shutter speed or to have the shutter be open twice as long and have the exposure remain roughly the same. Yes?
This long exposure, did you use automatic exposure or were you able to dive in the lens?
So when I'm talking about the exposure in this case, I didn't use automatic exposure because this is longer than 30 seconds. I had to use this bulb mode that I was referencing earlier on. So I had the remote shutter connected, and you just turn it on and basically allow it to keep the shutter open for that long. And it basically requires you having a stopwatch or a timer to be able to tell exactly how long it needs to be open. And if this photo on the right was 847 seconds or 845 or just some number of seconds off, it's really not going to make that big of a difference when we're talking about shutter speeds of this length. And that's why I wasn't too concerned in the first lecture with the pinhole camera if I was just a few seconds behind, because it's really not going to impact a great deal when we're talking about shutter speeds this long, the amount of light entering into the camera. So one of the things that you'll notice, not only did I decrease the ISO, but we also got less noise as a result. Yes? Yes, so the way that you know what the proper exposure will be, usually when something is this dark outside, so it was actually very, very dark at night, and the camera will not actually tell you very well how automatically what settings to use. Usually, sometimes it requires some trial and error. There are some devices out there that exist that will allow you to measure the amount of light, and then using that measurement, you can calculate the shutter speed, all of these settings that you want, the shutter speed, the ISO, the aperture that you want, in order to get the picture that you want. But those tend to be slightly expensive, at least a couple hundred dollars. And it seems better, at least a lot more fun, to be able to determine on your own what it is. However, unless it's like this photo where it was very, very cold and you're outside shivering and you just want to be done with it, that's why I used the high ISO at first, because I just wanted a short shutter speed and just wanted to be done with it. And so actually, I should mention before I move on from this, so you'll notice that I circled this red, I circled a star in red, and that was this star that I focused on in the later slide. And this star is actually Vega, I was told by an astronomer friend of mine. And so I just want to point something else out from this photo. You'll notice that hopefully you can see it here, but you can certainly see it a lot better, or at least I hope you can, from the slides that were handed out. You'll notice that they don't all of the slides or all of the stars, okay, I guess you can't really, sort of. So all of the stars don't go in a particular direction. So if this was my photo, and this is the horizon, they don't all sort of go the same direction. They all curve like this. Why is that? That's right. So I was pointed slightly north in this case, and so you can actually see the curvature or the rotation of the Earth in this case. If I had pointed to the right and up just a little bit, we would have seen the North Star, and it would have remained relatively center as all of the stars circle around it. And so this is certainly a neat feature of astrophotography, is that you can take some really interesting photos with different where you have star trails of different radii, and it really just makes the photograph appear interesting. Okay, so arguably, in just about every case, when you have time and when you're trying to take something that has a specific motion to it, you want to try to decrease the ISO as much as possible so that you get as little noise as possible in the photograph, because certainly, when you're presenting a photograph, you just want it to look very clean as you possibly can. So decrease the ISO if you can, and try to increase the shutter speed. But at 14 minutes, I didn't want to go down two stops. So what would have happened if this photo was taken at ISO 400? what would the shutter speed have been if I went all the way to ISO 100? So it's... So it's right now it's at 14 minutes, and if I go from ISO 400 to 200 to 100, this means that I am now two steps less sensitive. So I have to, that's right, so I have to multiply 14 by, so I have to multiply 14 by 2 twice. So 14 times 2 is 28, times 2 again is 56. So I would have been stuck out there freezing in the cold for 56 minutes just to get this star trail yet another doubling in length, or rather twice as, or four times as long in length. And so you can see that it quickly adds up, and you really have to take all of these things into account. What a lot of better astrophotographers will do is leave their camera outside, go inside, sit next to a fire, and just wait and wait and wait and hope that their battery doesn't die. And certainly at that point, when you're taking photos, remember that I mentioned that these sensors, they're like computer chips. They can get hot, and you can get some artifacts on the image that looks like some purple fringing along the bottom, just some weird colors that can happen as a result of this. And so usually taking photos like this when it's colder, or at least chillier, is better, because then you try to prevent this from actually happening. Okay, so this is an example of how shutter speed and ISO affect each other. You can give and take. If you need it to be faster, you can. If you need the shutter speed to be faster, you do what to the ISO? Right, you increase the ISO. And inversely, if you want to decrease the shutter speed, if you want to make the shutter open for longer, then you decrease the ISO. Okay, so there are actually some ways that we can quantitatively measure noise. And you'll see this primarily on a lot of really geeky digital photography websites, such as digitalphotographyreview.com, where they actually try to quantify the amount of noise that a particular camera has at each ISO step. And so you can see here that this is a graph comparing it compares one camera, but it talks about different amounts of noise. And so you'll notice that there's three lines here, and the yellow line is the luminance black, the gray line is the luminance gray, and the red line is the chroma noise. So I just want to go back a few steps to what we were talking about before, this initial view of ISO that I was showing you. And you notice that there, if you look at the noise, there's actually different types of noise. There's noise where it introduces some color into it. So you may notice in the black area that not only does it look a little bit lighter, but there's some spots that look a little bit more red or a little bit more blue, for example. That's chroma noise. You may get a difference in brightness. So that would be this luminance noise, those gray spots that you see. That's luminance noise versus the chroma noise, which is actually color that exists. And so they can quantify this, all of this stuff, and tell you how bad each of these types of noise is. Now, if you really are going to break it down like this, you're probably better off waiting until they can get this to be as flat as possible. That will never happen. But if you're really going to look at the fine details such as this, you're geeking out a bit, because frankly, it's how the noise looks. It's just as important as how much there is. And just like I was saying before, my argument with this sort of thing is that with film, it just looks much more organic, much more natural. So even though you may have slightly more noise, that may be acceptable compared to a similar amount of digital noise where it's patternized slightly and you can sort of see it just doesn't look right. It just looks artificial and not as good. So anyway, you can see that as we increase the ISO, we increase the ISO along the bottom, along the x-axis, we're also increasing these various types of noise as well. So measurements aren't everything. You just take a look at the different types of photos that you see, and where you will really see the impact of high ISO noise is in darker regions of a photograph. So if we go back again just a couple of steps, you'll notice that you can't really see the noise as easily in the photo of the stamp, but you can in the darker gray and the black sections. And certainly that is one way to compare the noise between them. Okay, so we went over shutter speed. We went over ISO. There's one more thing which is frankly scary. That is the aperture. So we were talking about how when you double or halve the amount of light, you're essentially doubling or halving the intensity of that light. And so just like how our pupil allows in a certain amount of light and the iris opens and closes the pupil so that we get more or less light in, much the same way do we have an aperture in a camera that closes down or opens up. And so let's see, I guess I'll be brave this time. And so on my camera, I have a 50 millimeter lens that has right now very wide aperture. If you take a look at it, you can see that, you know, it's relatively big. But if you push a button, and that's down here to the, so if you're looking at the camera like this and you go to the right and down, there's a button and you hear it makes just a very quiet noise. But what happens is that the aperture is becoming smaller. You can actually see the effect of having a smaller aperture here. And so if you get the camera, so I'm going to pass it around so that you can push this button and take a look at it. But if you get the camera and it's not working, turn it off and turn it back on, and it should hopefully work from there. So just go ahead and push this button down here, pass it around and take a look. But okay, so aperture. So just like how we have the iris that opens and closes to let in a certain amount of light through the pupil, much the same way we have this aperture. And there is actually a difference between the aperture, which is literally the hole that allows light through, that you will see changes in intensity or changes in size, and the F number and is actually the number that is important that we are talking about. And there's usually some confusion about aperture and F number, but we're not going to be too strict if you call an aperture something else. And so we'll talk about that in just a little bit. So what is the F number? So the aperture lets in a certain amount of light, and it's actually a really easy calculation to determine what the F number is given some very basic specs. So let's say we have this lens and it has a certain diameter. The aperture on this lens has a certain diameter. It may be like 5 millimeters or 10 millimeters, for example. And let's say that you further know the focal length. And the focal length is printed on just about every lens that exists. You can see it on digital, on compact cameras. You can certainly see it on lenses like this, and you can see it usually not on camera phones, but just about all of these lenses will have the information printed. And all you need to do to determine the F number is divide the focal length by the diameter. That's it. And you get the F number of that particular aperture, the size of that hole. And so realize that this sounds pretty nice and pretty easy, but it doesn't lend itself to very nice numbers. Remember that what do we need to do to increase or decrease by a stop the amount of light that exists? Double or half the amount of light. But we're talking about circles here. We're not talking about diameters. So we can't just double or half the diameter in order to double or halve the amount of light, because we're talking about the area of this circle. It's the area that's important. And if that area halves, then we will be halving the amount of light that comes in. And so this is where the complexity in aperture and F number comes in, is that there's not a one-to-one relationship between the diameter and the area. And so this is what this document that I passed around is useful for. It shows you how we can relate this F number to the diameter, and it certainly seems useful to be able to go over some of it now. So don't worry, I know it's been a number of years since some of you have done some math, so we will only do some simple stuff on the assignments and all that, but it just seems useful to be able to understand where these numbers come from. That's sort of the whole goal of this class. So let's say we have two apertures here. We have a large circle that has a certain area. We have a smaller circle that has a certain area. So we have A1 and A2. And now assume that A1, the area of this larger circle, of this larger aperture, is twice that of A2, which basically means that we are letting in twice as much light through A1. So this is one stop brighter than A2. Okay? So in order to do that, we have to have A1 is equal to 2 times A2. Now remember that the area of a circle, it's pretty easy to remember. Oh, this is terrible, Chuck. So the area of a circle is equal to pi times the radius squared. But what we are talking about is not the radius, so we have to add an additional complexity here. What we are talking about is the diameter. And the diameter of a circle, Man, this is terrible chalk. Yeah, I have some already broken chalk here, so this will be better. And I apologize that I am left-handed. This makes it difficult. I block everything that I write, so I'll try to move out of the way. So the diameter then is twice the radius, so that if we plug in this r is equal to, the radius is half the diameter, we can then figure out the area of a circle based on the diameter. So the area is equal to pi times the diameter divided by 2 squared. Okay? So far, so good. So now let's calculate what the area of each of these two circles should be. And the idea here is that what we want to do is try to figure out how the diameter differs between the two. Because if we know what the length of the diameter of A1 is and A2, we can then figure out what the difference is in one stop between the two just by dividing it by the focal length. So, okay, so we will take A1, and this is pretty easy. A1 is equal to, I say it's easy and then I write the wrong thing. How about that for? All right, so pi times the diameter over 2 squared. Let me move this out of the way so it's easier to see. So we square both of these things, and then we get realize that what I'm talking about here is the diameter of area 1. So I'm going to name it D1 to match with area 1. So then we get D1 squared over 4, because you have to square both, times pi. Okay, so we do the same thing for the area of 2, and it's literally just the same thing, but diameter 2 squared times pi over 4. Okay, so now what we have to do is try to put this all together. How can we figure out how the relationship between D1 and D2 differ based on knowing this? Well, we can plug in this data. So we have, where's a good place? I suppose I will do it right here. Okay, so A1 is equal to, the area of A1 is twice the area of A2. We figured out their areas in terms of their diameters, so we'll plug that in. So D1 squared pi over 4 is equal to 2 times D2 squared pi over 4. So now I realize that we have some common stuff on both sides. We can cancel out the 4s and the pi's, which is nice. So now what we have is that the diameter 1 squared is equal to twice the diameter 2 squared. So this, if nothing else, should hopefully convince you that we cannot just double or halve the diameter by itself in order to double or halve the stop when we're talking about the aperture. So if we keep going, let's say that we square root both sides. Now the diameter 1 is equal to root 2 times the diameter of 2. And root 2 is roughly equal to like 1.4-ish. So we'll say that D1 is actually D2. So the diameter of this larger circle is equal to the diameter of the smaller circle times 1.4. Okay? I know I'm going over this sort of quickly, but that's why this document is here, so that you can go home later and step through it yourself if you need some additional convincing. Okay, so now we know that I gave you this area of this circle 1, or I said that this is a certain area. I'm also going to give you a focal length. So just to make it easy on ourselves, let's say that this lens has a focal length of 1 for both of these areas. So focal length of 1, focal length of 1. And so let's further assume that the area of A1 is just 1, just to make it very easy on ourselves. So A1 right now is equal to 1. So this means that the area of A2 should be 1/2, but that doesn't really matter right now. And so, yes, so then we should be able to figure out what, no. Let's not say that area is equal to 1. I'm sorry. So what I want to do is just make this very, very easy. We want to figure out the F number of this lens that has the A1 with the larger aperture. And remember that the F number is equal to the focal length divided by the diameter. So I'll say the focal length is 1, And I'll say that the diameter is 1, not the area. I'll say the diameter is 1 so that when we actually do this calculation, so the F number of A1 then is the focal length divided by the diameter is just 1. It's just 1. Very easy, very simple to do. But what I wanted to do, the whole exercise, the whole point of this exercise is to figure out what one stop difference is. So we wanted to calculate the F number of A2. We were able to do that by determining the difference in the diameter. So now D1 is equal to D2 times 1.4. So with D1 being, or the diameter of 1 being 1, the diameter of 2 being unknown times 1.4, we do this math. D2 is equal to 1 over 1.4. And I did this slightly differently, but it ends up being exactly the same. I'm just going to switch back to our radicals. So the diameter of 2 is root 2 over 2. OK, so I know you'll hate me for that. Just 1 minute. All right, so now let's take the F number and find the F number of A2. So remember, this is A2. This is with half the diameter, or half the area. I'm sorry, because we're letting in half the amount of light, and which means that we are decreasing the size of the diameter by about 0.7. So it's about 70% the size of diameter 1. So this should be then the focal length of 1 over the diameter, root 2 over 2, which you do some math, and you find out that this should be root 2, which means that the F number of 2 is 1.4. Okay, so breathe, relax, calm down. It's very easy from this point on. We know that the F number of this F number for this first circle is 1. The F number of a circle that's half the size, or one stop away, is 1.4. And so you may realize that you may have seen some really crazy numbers for all of the apertures. Don't really worry about that. It's a very, very easy trick. So if you remember 1 and 1.4, which I'm sure all of you can do, especially when shown in the face of this, all you have to do is double each number to get the next F number. So let me erase some of this stuff. We have it all in your handout there, so you can review it if you want to. So we start the F numbers at 1 and then 1.4. Now to find the next F number, you take 1 and multiply it by 2. So that means you get 2. To get the next F number, you take the next number to multiply that by 2. So 1.4 times 2 is 2.8. You take the next one, 2, multiply it by 2, get 4. 2.8 times 2 is 5.6, so on and so forth. 8, 11, 16, 22, 32, so on and so forth. These are all of the F numbers that are one stop away from each other. Now remember that a camera will usually give you some intermediary stops as well. So between 1.4 and 2, you might have like 1.6 and 1.8. Between 2 and 2.8, you might have like 2.3, 2.6 or something around there, and so on and so forth. But these are the major stops that you should remember. And hopefully it'll be much easier if you just remember this quick trick by remembering 1 and 1.4. If you prefer to memorize them, that's certainly fine as well. So, okay, like I said, breathe, relax, don't worry too much about it. You have this document, or if you need additional convincing, go through each of the steps and hopefully it will make some sense. And this is what section is for. Hopefully you'll be able to figure all this out. Now realize that you won't have to do all of this math. Certainly when you're out in the field trying to take a picture, you're saying, okay, I'm having the area, so I have to, that means that I have to root 2 times the diameter. No, don't worry about all that. Just remember this trick, and you will be able to do it. But the reason for all of this was just to show you why these F numbers are as crazy as they are, whereas with the shutter speed and the ISO, we could very nicely double or half those numbers. Not so with these. We are decreasing the size of the area of the allowed in light and not actually decreasing the diameter, which is what the F number takes into account. Okay, so I figured that we should do one additional thing as well, and that is to calculate the F number of that pinhole that I took. Remember that it was basically just, it was this lens cap, or it's a body cap really, and I drilled a hole through it, put some aluminum foil on it, and used a little needle, and as steady as I could and as straight as I could, just put a little tiny hole in the center of that aluminum foil. And with this, that is an aperture that's letting in a certain amount of light, and we can therefore calculate the F number of that aperture. And so in my notes, I had a little cheat sheet that told me exactly how many times less light that little aperture was allowing in. And it was exactly 4,200 times less light. And the reason, and the way that I was able to calculate this as is that with that the camera lens combination that's being passed around, I basically took a photo at the camera's recommended settings at some shutter speed, whatever it was recommended, but I set the aperture of that lens to 2.0. And then what I did was I recorded, you know, the shutter speed of that, and it was, you know, 1/60th of a second or something like that. Excuse me. And then I put on the pinhole camera, or put on the pinhole lens, then through a set of trial and error would just have it take a photo and just let it keep going and going and going until I received a photograph that was approximately the same exposure. And what this tells me, then I could look at the shutter speed of that pinhole photo and determine how many times slower that shutter speed was compared to that 1/60th of a second or whatever it was that I took with this F2.0. And so it ended up being, as you can see, I wrote out more details here. It was 1/60th of a second with the 2.0 lens, and the shutter speed of the pinhole camera was 70 seconds. So you divide 70 by 1/60 and you get 4,200 times as, or 4,200 times darker. So what I then wanted to do was figure out the F number of that pinhole aperture. And in order to do that, remember that we are talking about stops, which is a doubling or a halving of the light. And it's not just 4,200. That doesn't make sense in terms of stops. So you have to figure out how many times 2 is multiplied by itself. So 2 times 2 times 2. So this would be 1 stop, 2 stops, 3 stops, 4 stops, so on and so forth. That would give us 4,200 times less light. Now, you can do this manually, or you can do it using logarithms, and I'll gloss over that. So you do a log of 2x, 2 to the x is equal to 4,200, or log of 4,200. And eventually you realize that x is equal to approximately 12. It's like 12.0 or something. It's very, very close to exact, which is wonderful. And so that is the number of stops. So you multiply 2 by itself 12 times, you get 4,200. That's basically what this is telling us. So now we know that this pinhole aperture is 12 stops darker than an F2.0 lens. So using that same number line that I had up here before, where I knew that 2 was one stop away from 2.8, it was one stop away from 4, 5.6, so on and so forth, I calculated what the F number of the pinhole should be. And if you count 12 stops away from F2.0, that means the F number is 128. So now I know the F number, and what I can do is figure out, what do I do with the chalk? That's strange. What I can do is figure out how large the aperture is, what the diameter of that aperture is, because remember, the F number is equal to the focal length divided by the diameter. So I know the F number, it's 128, and what is the focal length? Well, the focal length is basically measured from the entrance of the pinhole to where the sensor is exactly. And if you remember that symbol on the camera, this line with the circle through it, you can determine where on the camera that sensor is. So you just measure the distance from this all the way to the pinhole lens, you know, which looks like this, and then you realize that it's actually 50 millimeters. Okay, so then all you have to do is you plug that in. So you know the focal length is 50 millimeters divided by the diameter. So then the diameter is equal to 50 divided by 128. And we actually get the size of the aperture of the pinhole, which is 0.4 millimeters. Millimeters. Which I was frankly pretty proud of, because I didn't think I had that sort of resolution with a little tiny pinhole, but you can certainly do the same sort of tactic and see if you can best my 0.4 millimeter aperture. Okay, So that's aperture. So now realize that we have three things now that we can change to affect the outcome of a photograph. We can increase or decrease the aperture to increase to let in more or less light. And remember that the higher the F number, the less light you're letting in. So it's slightly counterintuitive. So we can increase or decrease the aperture, or the F number rather, to decrease or increase the amount of light that's coming in. We can increase or decrease the shutter, the length of time that the shutter speed or that the shutter is open, so on and so forth. But there is one thing that the aperture affects as well. Not only does it affect the amount of light, but it also affects the background blur, or how much the background is blurred compared to the subject that is focused. So in this case, this goes back to that sports photo of the two guys playing soccer. You can see that we have an aperture of f2.8. So this is, or an F number of f2.8. So as you have a lower F number for a given sensor size, and actually a different size sensor will affect this, but for a given camera, the lower your F number, the more background blur you will get. And this is usually what a lot of people like to do, especially in portraiture, when they really want to put focus on the subject, for example. They'll blur the background a bit so that the subject is in focus and everything else is not, so that there's no contention between the subject and the background. And it makes for a good photo as well for sports, because then you don't worry so much about the background, which, as you can see, is actually pretty busy between the cars and background and the building and all of that. It's not as noticeable as the subject itself. But so this is nice, because now having a low F number with a lot of background blur means we're letting in as much light as we possibly can, which means that I can have as fast of a shutter speed that I possibly can for this photo. And if I need to make it even faster, I can increase the ISO. And so you'll notice that the ISO isn't 100 in this case, it's 200, because I wanted to get that additional stop of speed. So if I had stayed at ISO 100, then I would have had to have gone down to about 1/600th of a second rather than 1/1250th of a second, which would not have blurred or would not have frozen the action as well. So there's a variety of things that you can do to affect your image. If I had, like I said, if I decreased the ISO, I'd have to use a slower shutter. I would have to keep the shutter open for more time, which means more blur. Or if I had increased the F number, that means I would have let in less light, so I would have had to increase the ISO, or I would have had to do the same with the shutter speed. And generally in sports, what you want to do is have the fastest shutter speed that you possibly can to make sure that you really freeze that action. So this usually means increasing the ISO a bit and having the F number be as low as possible so that you can have the most, you can have the fastest shutter speed that you can and really freeze the action. And this is where very low F number lenses come in handy, because you can let in several stops additional light and really freeze that action where you couldn't otherwise. So the other thing, if you go the other way, rather than have the aperture be completely open, you can do what's called stopping it down, or make the aperture much smaller, which increases the depth of field, which basically means that more is in focus. So rather than having a blurry background, you could now have maybe an in-focus subject and an in-focus background. So in this case, in this photo, for example, I used a relatively small aperture. Well, I was using a compact camera, which also affects the background blur, but I used a relatively small aperture, a high F number, F8, in order to really make as much of the photo in the photo as crisp and as in-focus as possible. So this actually, because this was taken with a smaller sensor, the sensor size actually affects the amount of background blur. So F8 in an SLR image, for example, so F8 maybe on this lens would not have as similar, as striking of a difference between, in terms of the background blur, whereas you would definitely be able to tell the background is less blurry, but it is not as in focus, if this makes sense, as this one that had a smaller sensor. So when you have a compact camera, you may really want this. You may want to get as much as you possibly can in focus and have very large depth of field. And that is what a smaller camera, what a larger F number will allow you to do. If you have a larger sensor, a lower F number, you're going to get more background blur. And personally, really, it really depends on what you personally want to achieve out of photograph to determine what you want to do. So this actually, it's a slight lie. I did another step as well to make sure that as much of this was in focus as possible, called the hyperfocal distance. And that's basically a distance of that you can focus a specific lens, and everything from half that distance to infinity will be in focus. I'm glossing over it now because we'll talk about it in the optics lecture. Okay, so we've talked about three things that you can change on the camera to impact the exposure, each with their upsides, each with their downsides, advantages, disadvantages, what happens when you change one, how the others must be changed as well. But there's a fourth thing as well that affects the exposure. That's the amount of light. Many people forget about this fourth thing, but if you have more light, you can do more, so to speak, with your shutter speed or with your aperture. You can have a faster shutter speed, or you can really increase the F number to get more in focus. And so this is why using, for example, a flash unit may be handy. And you'd be able to actually take a photograph with a shutter speed that's reasonable enough for you to be able to hold the camera. This is by increasing the amount of available light or decreasing it, you can then change or affect the rest of these settings on your camera as well. So there's actually there's a pretty good, somewhat reliable method of trying to determine exposure settings to use when outside in a bright sunny day. And so this is called the Sunny 16 rule. And it basically says that if you have a shutter speed of 1/100th of a second, you're using a sensitivity of ISO 100, you can then set the aperture to f/16, and be able to get a well-exposed photograph. Now, this requires that you're outside and it's very, very bright and very, very sunny. We actually have very few days of that sort of weather around here. Even in the brightest, sunniest summer days, you may notice that because of our latitude, we don't actually get as much sun as we would, for example, in the equator. So you might take this into account. Maybe you would try aperture f/11 instead. But basically, this is a pretty important and pretty useful rule to remember. And when it's slightly overcast, for example, you might try going down one stop. So you might try letting in an additional stop of light, which means that we would do what to the shutter speed? If it's one stop darker because it's overcast, how would this affect the shutter speed?
Slow it down by half to a
50th. Yep, we would slow it down by half to 1/50th of a second. Remember that 1/50th that means that we are letting the shutter speed be open, we are letting the shutter be open for twice as long as 1/100th of a second. How about the sensitivity, the ISO? How would that be affected by one stop down? So let's say we go back up to 1/100th of a second for the shutter speed. Right, double the ISO, so ISO 200. That's another thing that we could do. What about the aperture? You might have to get your cheat sheet if you don't yet know the numbers, but if we wanted it to be one stop brighter because it's darker outside, yep, we would open it more, which means it's a lower F number, which means 11. F11. Right, exactly. So if we're slightly overcast, we might go down one stop, make it F11. Okay, so if it's more than slightly overcast, you would go down two stops, which means that we would make the shutter speed down to 1/125th of a second. We'd make the ISO go to ISO 400, or we would make the aperture go to f/8, or we could do a combination of any of these things. We could make the shutter speed go to 1/50th of a second, we could keep the sensitivity the same, and make the aperture go down one stop as well to f/11. So you can see that there's give and take in, excuse me, there's give and take in all of these things. So you can really pick and decide what you want to do. And certainly I think that having a shutter speed of 1/100th of a second outside during a bright sunny day is somewhat limiting. So you may want to go down maybe four stops or five stops in the aperture because you can. F/16 is really a very, very small aperture. Maybe you'll go down four, maybe five stops if possible, and increase your shutter speed to be representative. So if you go down four stops, then that means that the shutter speed would be ISO 200, 400, 800, 1600. So you'd have 1/1600th of a second shutter speed by going down an aperture in four numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, which would be F4, right? Yes, it's tough to go backwards in your mind. So F4, if you set the aperture to F4 on the Sunny 16 rule, you can therefore have a shutter speed that is 16 times faster, which is very, very useful. Heavy overcast, somewhat cloudy, go down 3 stops to F5.6 and adjust accordingly. So now you can use the manual mode. Go out and try it. You know how all of these 3 settings can affect the exposure on your camera. When you take a photo, if it doesn't look right, maybe it's overexposed, maybe it's underexposed, you know what you're supposed to do to each of these 3 settings, or to any of the 3 settings, or to some combination of the 3, to be able to brighten up your photograph or to darken it down a little bit. So, so just to give you an additional idea, if we are, let's say we take a photo outside and it is Sunny 16, we can use the Sunny 16 rule just fine. Then we come back later and it's a full moon and it's completely dark outside with the full moon. It's about 18 or 19 stops slower than that, which means that we would then need, at ISO 100 and F16, we would need a shutter speed of 50 minutes. That's about 20 stops slower. So that's quite a big difference. And you can see where some of these problems can arise with darker environments. Okay, so one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this assignment is talking about the moon landings and how some conspiracy theorists have said that one of the reasons that these have been faked is because of a lack of stars in the background. And I don't want to do much more than other than just mention it, but just think about why that's not really a good reason for this conspiracy theory. And so this photo here was taken actually by a relatively modern mission, by Japan's aeronautical agency, basically Japan's analogy of NASA. And they actually took HD video of the Earth rise over the moon, which is really, really cool, though kind of slow. It takes forever, the Earth to rise, and it gets sort of boring unless you jump ahead a little bit. But when you do get to the meaty part, the really good part, then it's just amazing. It's staggering, and it's really beautiful to see. And I'll post a link to that on the website later. Okay, so just quickly, a couple of things. Remember that overexposure means that you are allowing in too much light into the camera, and you are going to have some overexposure problems. You're going to lose detail in certain things like these rocks where the sun is hitting them very, very harshly, and you lose the detail because it's too bright for the camera sensor to be able to do it. And this poses some interesting problems for us. We could do a variety of things, like we could take this photo, then stop it down a couple of stops, so maybe we'll increase the aperture by a little bit, increase the F number a little bit so that when we take another photo, it will then be darker. This is called bracketing. As long as you can keep the camera still, you can take one photo. Well, you can take several photos with different exposure settings and be able to get different lightness and darkness values and then be able to combine them at a later date in Photoshop. And we'll talk about doing some of that stuff. Or you can try to increase the amount of light or decrease the amount of light that exists. So you'll notice that I have harsh light here. Maybe I could have tried to decrease some of that light there by maybe having someone stand awkwardly above it and try to block it while being out of the frame. Or maybe I could have had a flash on the inside of this cave entrance here so that it increases that light, and it really then that way I can just make this whole thing that's sort of more level intensity in terms of brightness. Okay, so underexposure is sort of the opposite. It's where you lose details because things are too dark. You'll notice that this is a relatively troublesome area because the sky is actually somewhat properly exposed. You can see the details in the clouds and in the mountain, but the mountain below in the trees, you just lose everything. So when you're going to take landscape photos such as this, you're outdoors, really there's a couple of really good times to do it, and there's some really bad times to do it. The bad times are when it's noon and you have the sun is very, very high, the sun is very harsh, and it's beating down on you and everything else around you. The best times to do it really are dawn or dusk, when you have softer light. Light is really reflecting all over the place, and you get also just very, very warm colors in the photograph. And Not only does it even out the exposure, but you also get some really beautiful colors as well. So get up early or go to bed late, because those are when you will get the best photographs. Okay, so this is an embarrassing photograph, but this shows you what can happen when you have both under and overexposure in the same photograph. So you can see that I've lost details in the bridge in the left, and I've lost details in the sky to the right. Frankly, if you have a situation such as this, unless you have a lot of lighting equipment where you can really brighten up the inside of this, or you have the time to just wait until the evening when the sky will be a bit darker, you're going to be out of luck. And I just gave up on this photo. When I took it, I said, oh, I should have known that the dynamic range is just not going to be high enough in order to capture detail everywhere. Plus, it's just not a very interesting photo. This big wooden thing down the center, it's just a horrible, horrible photo. Okay, so there are some cases, though, that you would actually want to intentionally under or overexpose something. So, for example, a product shot where you want to isolate the product from everything else, you want to try to get the background as black as possible. And that is the case here. Just by using some flash and literally a black shirt that was hanging some distance behind it, you can illuminate the object and not the background behind it. So there's a couple of considerations here, and that is that you want to make sure that the black shirt is far enough away that if you can get any details in it, when you take the photograph with a relatively low F number, you're not going to get that black shirt in focus. The other thing is you want to make sure that you don't actually illuminate the black shirt at all. It's very, very tricky, but certainly something that you should try to do, because it's just fun when you can accomplish it. Also, intentional overexposure. This was done with white sheets of paper that were sitting behind it. And what I did was I basically used the flash to illuminate the white sheets, and then allowed I had some reflectors and some other things that allowed the front of the bottle to be illuminated slightly as well. But the point is that you just so completely overexpose the background that you lose details and you get a completely white background. Okay, so that's it for exposure. Thank you all for coming. We don't meet next week, but when we come back, we'll continue talking about exposure and some flash stuff.